The third case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A22-1573, State of Minnesota versus Daryl Shannon Williams. Council are familiar with our procedures. Council for appellant, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Daryl Williams. This court must reverse Mr. Williams' conviction because his trial was dramatically unfair. For example, the victim's statement at the scene was an excited utterance when the state wanted to bring it in, but when the defense wanted to bring it in, suddenly it was not. The state was able to sneak into evidence the victim's accusation that Mr. Williams was the shooter, even though the state didn't call the victim to testify. And the lead detective was allowed to express his personal opinion that Mr. Williams was the shooter. And I'd like to start there in detail because I think it's the easiest way for this court to resolve the case. In State versus Hogvet, this court held that testimony like this one was, quote, egregious, because in Hogvet, the court wrote, quote, in essence, the officer told the jury that he believed the appellant was guilty in that case of assaulting the victim. Well, there's no essence here. The lead detective was asked very dramatically multiple times, who do you think the shooter was? And he very clearly said at least twice he thought the shooter was Mr. Williams.
Counsel, why doesn't the statement fit into the Supreme Court's decision in DeWald, where the Supreme Court said that the officer can testify about an ultimate issue so long as they don't make an ultimate conclusion? And in that case, I think that they said the officer can say someone killed the victim, but they can't say that somebody murdered the victim.
Right.
And why is saying he's the shooter versus he's the attempted murderer? Like, why isn't that same distinction present here?
I think for the same reason it wasn't present in this court's decision in Jones from a couple years ago, which is not precedential, but I think is really helpful here. In Jones, the officer looked at a video recording of an interaction between the defendant and the complaining witness in that case, and the officer opined, I've looked at that video, and I think you grabbed her in a sexual way. The officer here did the same thing. All the officer here did was look at videotapes. He didn't see the shooting. He wasn't an eyewitness to the shooting. That's all he did was he looked at videotapes. And so then he gave his opinion, just like the officer in Hogvet gave his opinion. The officer in Hogvet was called to the scene. He asked some questions, and he made a conclusion. Now, officers do that all the time, of course. But it's not admissible testimony at a trial because the officer's opinion about whether the defendant is guilty is, A, not admissible, and, B, extremely prejudicial because of its source. And that's what the Hogvet court recognized, that when this statement comes from a police officer, the jury is going to pay explicit and express attention to it and is going to follow it. And that's especially true in this case because this case, the officer here did what the jury was supposed to do, which is look at the tapes. The evidence against my client that's admitted at the trial, other than this, the evidence that the victim accused my client of being the shooter, which was plainly inadmissible, the vast majority of the evidence was the videotapes. And the jury was supposed to compare the person on the videotape coming out of the apartment to the person on the videotape inside the Speedway before the shooting to the person who committed the shooting. And that's all the jury was supposed to do. And that's all the officer did. And he said, well, I think the defendant's guilty. Prosecutor can say that, but a witness can't.
Well, he didn't say, I think that he's guilty. He said, I think he's the shooter.
Well,
think that in DeWald, that was the distinction that they were making, right?
I'm not sure it matters in this case, Your Honor. I think that I don't recall the precise issue in DeWald, so I don't think it's cited in the state's brief, so I'm a little bit on my back foot there.
Sorry.
But I think when you say, you know, in this case, it's not a self-defense case, for example. So to say the defendant is the shooter in this case means the defendant is guilty. If he's the shooter, he's guilty. That's the whole question in this case is, who is the shooter? And if the issue in DeWalt, and I can look it up and I can come back and address it, but if the issue in DeWalt, for example, was, you know, what was the cause of death, and the officer didn't say murder, well, then maybe that's different. But in this case, the officer, when you say he's the shooter, you're saying he's guilty. And so if you look to the four factors as to why...
I guess one other question about that. Can you clarify whether in Hogvedt or in Jones it was a plain error review or whether there were objections to that testimony?
In Jones, it was not plain error. It was objected to. There are other unpublished cases. Uall is one, and they're cited in our brief, where this court has found plain error here. For situations like this. In fact, in one of the cases, the testimony, finding plain error, the testimony, I think it's in Uall, was much vaguer than this. The officer in that case said something like, I think a crime was committed here. And this court held that that was plain error. Now, in that case, the court held it wasn't reversible. It didn't affect the defendant's substantial rights. But on the front couple of prongs of plain error, this court has been very clear since Hogvedt that witnesses aren't allowed to do this. There's another precedential case that's cited in the brief in which the rule is extended even to people like human resources officers from a school. In that case, the state introduced evidence that the human resources officer who was the defendant's like supervisor basically had fired him as a result of this allegation, and this court held that communicated to the jury that human resources thought the allegation was true. And that was erroneous. And that the same principle applies here. And there's a reason this doesn't happen. You don't have police officers giving this sort of opinion. I'd actually never seen it before, where it is elicited this explicitly. I mean, I think that's the other problem here, is that it's not a blurt out. The officer in Hogvedt, I think was a non-responsive answer to a question, because the judge had previously warned everybody not to have this happen, and the officer did it anyway. This court still reversed. Here, the prosecutor very deliberately elicited this opinion, and very dramatically, and did it in a way where it ended, it was the last thing before cross-examination, of the lead homicide detective. So that's the sort of compelling manner that goes to why this is reversible error, not just plain error. In addition, Mr. Williams can't counter that testimony. I mean, the officer's telling the truth. He believes Mr. Williams is the shooter. So there's no way to cross-examine him or shake him from his opinion. You can put on a defense, and Mr. Williams did, but you can't counter the inadmissible testimony. And again, the videos were essentially the entire case. And the two issues that go together here are that testimony and also the testimony of both officers who purport to identify Mr. Williams in the videos. That evidence was also inadmissible because those officers have no experience with Mr. Williams. They don't know him any more than the jury knows him. Judge Larson, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to ask, with regard to your objections to the victim's out-of-court statements, would you agree... Or I guess, what's your position if the identification had not come in? Do you would you be making the same arguments regarding the impact or the harmless error to this case?
When you say identifications, Your Honor, which identifications are you talking
the,
about?
The testimony about the picture and the victim identified. If that evidence had not come in, would you have the same objections to the district court's decision to not allow in the other testimony about the Joker and at the hospital?
I do think they kind of go together. I understand that those kind of go together. Because the problem in this case is, I think the direct answer to your question, Your Honor, is if the accusation from the victim that my client is Joker, if the jury never hears that, then it probably doesn't matter that they didn't hear that the victim accused Joker of shooting him. The problem is that the jury did hear that my client is Joker. And the prosecutor knew they were going to do that.
I mean, so your real problem with the hearsay decisions overall is that the the hearsay statements that were helpful to the state came in, and the ones that were less helpful to the state were the hearsay statements that did not come
100%
in.
100% agree, Your Honor. That is the problem in a nutshell. And it's particularly true with regard to the walk back that the victim makes. Because what he says at the scene is, Joker shot me. And what he tells the police, that doesn't come in. What does come in, the prosecutor, in his opening statement at page 54, told the jury, quote, "You're going to hear and learn that Mr. Brown recognized the suspect and that he provided a picture of that suspect to law enforcement officers." That's the state's opening. That's before defense counsel does anything. So the state is always going to introduce, they're going to find a way to get in the fact that the victim told the officers, "That's Joker, that's the guy who shot me," and that happened here.
And that happened before defense counsel asked Officer One, that did or did not happen before defense counsel asked Officer One about the photo before the state asked about the photo.
Correct. Well, yes, the state's opening statement obviously happened first. I agree that in chronological fashion, defense counsel is the first one to say, "Well, you got that accusation from the victim, right?" And the officer said, "Yeah, we did." And then on direct of the next officer, the state takes that and runs with it and asks three more questions about, "You got this from the victim told you this was the shooter." Then what happened? It was the next day that the district court said, actually, you're not going to be allowed to introduce the victim's later statements where he said, actually, the shooter was wearing a mask. I didn't see who the shooter was. I just kind of assumed it was this guy named Joker because we have some unarticulated beef. And the district court said, that is inadmissible. You can't bring that in to the defense over defense objection. So the result of all this is that the jury hears the worst piece of evidence for the defense, that it's clearly a confrontation clause violation. I mean, it's clearly a testimonial statement made to law enforcement as part of their investigation. The United States Supreme Court has told us the defense cannot open the door to a confrontation clause violation. So the fact that defense counsel referenced this identification is really irrelevant to the confrontation clause issue. It comes in violation of the confrontation clause. The defense counsel said, look, if you want to bring in everything the guy said, that's fine. We can deal with it. But what you can't do is bring in only the parts that benefit the state and leave out the parts that don't. Because that gives not only is that not fair, not fundamentally unfair to the defense, it gives the jury, and that's kind of the overall problem with this case, is that the jury has a false perspective of what happened. What the jury thinks happened is there was a shooting, the victim identified this man as the shooter, the police investigated this man, and these surveillance videos look kind of suspicious because maybe they can put him near the scene of the crime. That's the case that's given to the jury. What really happened is that's true, except the victim also said, actually, I don't even know if that guy was the shooter. And that's really, really critically important evidence when you don't have any eyewitnesses. If you should look at the videos of the shooting themselves. If you haven't, I encourage you to do so. You can't see anything. You can't see who the shooter is. It's pretty blurry. It's white. It's black and white. Nobody thinks you can identify anyone, including whether it's a man or a woman or high or tall or black or white or anything as the shooter.
Does the video reveal whether the shooter was masked or not masked?
It sure looks like, Your Honor, the shooter is masked. It's not super clear because the video is kind of grainy, but there's some testimony about a surgical mask, like a white surgical mask, and this is 2021. People are wearing masks. And it appears he's got a hood up over his head, and it appears he's got something in front of his face. And the... So that's what the victim tells the police, and that's what the video would, basically corroborate, is that the shooter was wearing a mask. But the jury doesn't know that. If you want to piece it apart, starting from the very beginning, when the judge says, a man who's just been shot 11 times is not excited enough to make an excited utterance, 2 minutes later, I realize how much discretion we give district court judges on things like, are you excited enough? That flies in the face of logic. And if you look at Exhibit 7, which was the body cam video from the responding officer that was admitted at the trial, it doesn't have the Q&A that's excluded where the man names Joker. But it's you can see how chaotic this scene is. The officers are yelling at Mr. Brown. With all due respect, they don't have a very calm bedside manner. They're shouting at him to get out of the car. They're shouting at him about he's been shot. He's been shouting that he's been shot. They're shouting at him about tourniquets and wrestling him to the ground. This is not a calm, you know, something out of a movie where the music is swelling and we're holding the guys, he's dying in the corner and there's a soft question and answer. This is the kind of exchange that creates an excited utterance.
I think the district court's reasoning, I'm characterizing it perhaps, is that despite this stressful situation, he was subdued or something like that.
Yep. I think that is what the district court said.
Does that put it within excited utterance or the stress of excitement, or does it take it out?
I think what puts it in the stress of excitement is you've just been shot 11 times, and the question is who shot you. The question isn't what'd you have for breakfast that morning.
But his behavior seemed outwardly calm, subdued. I'm not sure what words the district court used.
I know what you're saying, Your Honor, and I understand that is the district court's order. I guess I would suggest you look at the video and see for yourself.
Well, and in the video, he is screaming, "Help me!" And I've been shot everywhere. He does appear to be reacting as someone might after they'd been shot 11 times.
Right, and it's not 3 hours later. It's right there. It's within minutes of him being shot. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Appellant has raised a slew of evidentiary challenges, some of which he properly raised and preserved below, but many which he did not. And I'm happy to address any questions that this panel has for me regarding any of those claims, but I'm going to focus my initial comments on that alleged recantation that the victim made 3 days after the shooting on November 23rd.
Could you focus on the Confrontation Clause issue and the identification of the victim's identification of the appellant without him showing up for trial?
I want to be very clear, based on my reading of the transcript, as far as I understand, and as I note in my brief, the state never elicited any hearsay testimony from any of the 8 witnesses that the victim, who goes by the initials BB, identified appellant as the specific person who shot him. The word Joker appears 43 times in appellant's brief, and if you go through, like I have, and you cite check every single one of those, there is nowhere the jury was ever present in the courtroom and they were told that the victim said, "Joker shot me." That is discussed on the record, but the jury is never in the courtroom during those discussions.
But in closing argument, you agree that the state said, "You heard that the detectives received a photograph of the shooter from Mr. Brown." And later in the closing argument, the state said, "When you look at the evidence in this case, it shows you that Mr. Brown gave a photograph to the officers, photograph that the officers learned was involved, contained the shooter, that Mr. Williams identified himself as the same person, which led the other investigation, which led to the officers and the detectives pulling that video."
I have 3 responses to that. First off, as you were discussing before, this is invited error. This is ineffective assistance of counsel. Both claims that weren't raised because it was appellant that elicited this particular evidence first.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that the U.S. Supreme Court said in Hempel that you can't open the door to Confrontation Clause issues?
I don't think it's a Confrontation Clause issue. I don't think there's any hearsay testimony that was elicited from the victim that was put in front of the jury. And going back to the 2 closing arguments, the first portion that you cited was from page 32 of the 6th volume. It's a single sentence. It says, "You heard the detectives received a photograph of the shooter from victim." Period. That's it. The prosecutor did not quote or attribute any out-of-court statements made by the victim, out-of-court statements that would have been offered for the truth of the matter asserted, which is the second requirement for a confrontation clause violation during that closing. Rather, appellant immediately quoted, then the trial prosecutor at that point then immediately quoted appellant himself in his post-Miranda interview, in which he identified himself, a statement of a party opponent, as one of the people that's, you know, depicted in that photograph, Exhibit 71. The second part of the closing argument that you just quoted from was from page 69 of the sixth volume, and that is referencing the photo as a way of explaining why that investigation began to focus on appellant, how it was appellant who then, you know, subsequently asked and identified himself in that photo, and then how law enforcement began to gather all of the surveillance video and began to see how the different pieces of surveillance video from different locations fit together.
How do you not read the closing argument at page 69, where he's saying, Mr. Brown gave the photo that the officers learned was involved contained the shooter, as not being admitted for the truth of the matter asserted that the shooter was in the photo that the victim gave to the police officer?
There are four people in that photo. So it's not saying, he never identifies which of the four people. Look at Exhibit 71. There's four different people. One of them is appellant, and appellant self-identifies himself in that exhibit. But there's three other people in there. So it's not saying, yes, that picture included the person that He shot him, but there's three other options as opposed to just like a single mugshot or something like that.
So your position is that there was no testimonial hearsay statement that was ever admitted because all that ever came in was that Mr. Brown gave a photo to the officers.
And a person in the photo was believed to be the shooter. And the photo, of course, included four different people. I think if you look at the three prongs going back to your original confrontation clause.
And so there's no testimony in the record that Brown identified appellant as the shooter?
There is not.
Okay.
No. There's plenty in the descriptions of what the out-of-court statements would have said. And going back to how the trial prosecutor, you know, spoke in his opening statement, I think there was a hope, a belief at some point that the victim was going to testify in this case. That was the reason for the motions in limine that were filed before trial, that were then abandoned during the course of the trial about the victim's out-of-court statements, because the prosecutor's view, the state's view, the district court judge's view is those statements would only have been admissible if the victim had actually testified. And as the state made very clear in the sentencing hearing, they tried to have him come. They were never able to personally serve him. And without that, they were never able to ask for a warrant when the trial began and the victim did not appear to testify. So because of that, they were very much hoping to try this case as an attempted murder case. But as Judge Ascolani explained in, you know, ruling on the residual hearsay exception issue that was raised below, one of the claims actually that was challenged below, the state was forced to try this case more along the lines of a murder case in which you didn't have a victim.
Well, and I think it is pretty clear from the record that that is how the judge was trying to run the case. I guess my concern is if this was a murder case, you wouldn't have had the victim handing a photograph to the police officers and that evidence coming in. And I guess that's, you know, if the prosecution was really running this like a true murder case, you're not going to have, you know, the victim several, or I can't remember what, a week later or 10 days later, saying, here's a photograph of the guy that shot me, and handing that to the officers. That wouldn't have been the kind of evidence that you have in a standard murder trial.
And speaking with the trial prosecutor and information that's not documented on the record, I don't believe he ever intended to have that information come in terms of the source of the photo. It was intended to be used as a tip. It was appellant's trial counsel, not Mr. Butler, appellant's trial counsel who elicited specifically the existence of that photograph and the source of that photograph and the fact that the shooter was believed to be one of the people depicted in that photograph. That came into evidence before it was elicited by the prosecutor in any way. It was intended to be used as a tip along the lines of what informed the investigation.
Do you disagree with appellant that that was part of the preview and opening statement, was that there was a photograph given by the victim?
I believe that that I don't dispute Mr. Butler's recitation of the opening statement. I believe that that was the hope is that the victim was going to testify, and then talking to the victim about this photograph would have been fair game at that point if he was on the witness stand.
If that's in the state's opening argument, then how can you? I mean, then you would understand why defense counsel would feel that they can ask questions about it if it's clear from the opening statement that the state is planning to elicit that information.
The state was hoping to, but obviously anything that's said in an opening statement is not evidence. And I mean, if there was going to be an opportunity to have, you know, the victim testify, there would be plenty of opportunities after that for cross-examination on the statement or on the photograph and the statements that were made around it. And I think it's also important to clarify for the purposes of this court's review what's really being asked in terms of the specific statements, because we have a 10-day period of time. We have November 20th, I believe, 2021, is when the shooting happened at the Speedway. 3 days later is when there was the, I referred to it earlier, about that recantation in which the detective went to the hospital where the victim was sedated and medicated, and that is where the victim provided, again, nothing that's in front of the jury, but information that was put on the record in the form of discussing the police reports that he expressed, you know, he backtracked or expressed, you know, that there was... that maybe it was not necessarily Joker, never identifying, you know, Darrell Williams by the name Darrell Williams, but using the term Joker. Then 7 days later, after, you know, so on November 30th, then we have the victim now out of the hospital, no longer under the same medication, and a week later, he could not remember the conversation that he had with the detective in the hospital on November 23rd. And it's those November 23rd statements that the record indicates that the victim himself had no recollection a week later of ever making that Judge Ascolani was being asked to admit as an out-of-court statement. And that is why she found that they did not have any inherent or sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness, because the own declarant did not remember making them.
But then to finish the story, the victim then said, here's a photograph, and this is the guy who is Joker.
A person in this photo was the shooter, and then the detectives used that to continue or start the investigation.
Not in front of the jury, but, I mean, in real life, what actually happened was he said, this is the guy that's the shooter.
I don't correct. Believe that part's on the record. I don't believe he ever pointed and said, this guy. I think he said he's in this photo. And then the law enforcement then used an agency that was able to pull up some more information about each of those individuals and ended up ruling out three of them as part of their investigation.
Is there any dispute that Mr. Williams is Joker, that's a nickname that he is known by?
I don't think it was particularly disputed. I believe, I think it's around page 200 of the fourth volume of the trial transcript. There's testimony from Detective Ewert, Mr. Butler can correct me if I'm wrong when he gets back up here, that says that they associated Joker as being an alias or a name associated with Darrell Williams.
And was there evidence that he also went by the nickname Money?
I believe the only place I've seen that in the record is, I'm not sure if I've seen that in the record. To be full candor, I know it's been referenced in Mr. Butler's briefing, and if it is, I just missed it, but I don't believe there's anything in the record that establishes that.
When defendant tried to elicit, I think, am I correct, that the testimony from an officer about BB's statement that he wasn't sure. What was the grounds of the state's objection?
I'm sorry, Judge Johnson, can you clarify which particular statement you're talking about?
Well, the statement, am I correct, that one of the challenges here is to the exclusion of the any evidence about BB's statement that I'm not sure who shot me, or I can't remember.
The November 23rd, right. Yeah, statement. Mm-hmm. The one who was in the hospital.
And what was the grounds of the state's objection to that offer of evidence?
I think it was being offered under the residual exception to the rule against hearsay. And I think the state's position was that it was undermined considerably by a different out-of-court statement that was made 7 days later, and that Justice didn't have any guarantees of trustworthiness. In fact, neither of the statements would have had any guarantees of trustworthiness in terms of the November 23rd or the November 30th statement. And so I think there was no basically way around the rule against hearsay at that point. And I know that there were some. I don't think that Judge Ascolani relied on her on the Confrontation Clause concerns as much as it's put forth in Mr. Butler's brief, but I believe there was some issue there about perhaps inviting an ineffective assistance claim down the road if all of the victim's out-of-court statements, in which he said some pretty clear things on November 30th implicating appellant, came in trial. Judge Larson, I don't mean to call on you by any means, but I thought you were perhaps asking a question before Judge Johnson.
I was going to move on to the excited utterance issue. I'm just going to be blunt. I mean, I watched the video, and in some ways this seems like kind of textbook criminal procedure excited utterance, and I recognize that Judge Ascolani did some pretty detailed findings, but I'm not quite sure when you would have an excited utterance if it's not when you've been shot within 2 minutes of being shot 11 times, and the officer is clearly trying to give aid to a person who is in a pretty tough condition.
I have a few responses to that. This court's welcome to make rule as a matter of law that this particular factual scenario requires an excited utterance. It was not in existence in case law at the time that Judge Ascolani was making this decision, and as your Honor just pointed out, she did exhaustively support her decision. And I believe that a clear abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard of review here, and we also have to remember what she was being presented with at that time. I understand that video, and I'm not sure exactly chronologically when that video would have been shown to her in the presentation of the evidence, because you had Judge Ascolani, if you read the trial transcript, giving opposing counsel, or I should say, not Mr. Butler, appellant's trial counsel, several opportunities to try to elicit the information that would meet that third. Judge Johnson, I see I'm about to run out of time. Can I finish my answer to Judge Larson? Thank you. That trying to elicit the information from, I think it was Officer Buck, about how the victim was still under the stress of excitement, that third requirement for the excited utterance, and appellant's trial counsel was just not able to elicit anything that was going to be helpful or that was going to be supportive of what it sounds like Your Honor, Judge Larson, is seeing from that video, including telling Judge Ascolani, watch the video, look at this, how can it be any other way? Again, there's been no ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim that's been presented to this court. I can see why a strategy of trying to show the fact finder or the gatekeeper in terms of the district court judge, this is what it actually looked like at the time, could have been compelling for whatever strategic reason. Trial counsel chose not to do it that way and was not able to build a record that allowed Judge Ascolani and the exercise of her discretion to find it being an excited utterance. I'm way past time. I'm happy to entertain any other questions. Otherwise,
it appears there are none. Thank you, Mr. Petras.
Thank you.
Mr. Butler, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
I'd like to correct a couple things about the record. To Judge Larson's question about the video, the state offered, admitted, and played the video for the jury and for Judge Ascolani on page 83 of the transcript during the direct examination of the first witness, Officer Buck. The defense didn't try to get in the hearsay statements until cross-examination of that witness, and every one of their attempts was rejected. So this idea that the defense attorney, that Judge Ascolani somehow hadn't seen that video when those attempts were made is not true. She had. As far as what the hearsay evidence was as to who the shooter was, page 200, and the volumes are not consecutively paginated, so that's not helpful. But if you look at the July 14th, 2022 transcript, page 200, this is the direct examination of Officer Ewalt. And the question is, at some point during your investigation of this case, did you develop any leads that would identify the shooter? I did. What lead did you identify? I was given a photo, and it was pointed out that the person in the photo was the shooter. Now, that's passive voice. I understand that. But you don't get to launder hearsay and confrontation clause violations by using the passive voice. It was pointed out that the person in the photo was the shooter is not, it is the officer saying, I was told that the person in the photo was the shooter. The jury knew that that photo came from the victim, Mr. Brown. The jury knew that Mr. Brown told the police the person in the photo was the shooter. The jury knew that Mr. Brown, contrary to what counsel, I think, said today, there are four people in that photo. Mr. Brown identified one of them and said, that's Joker. Not the other, and the state then, I'm sorry, the police then did go on to eliminate the other three, but they asked, the next set of questions are to the officer about submitting the photo to the Hennepin County Special Facial Recognition Task Force to look at Mr. Williams. There's no information they looked at all those guys. They only looked at Mr. Williams. The state said, that's the guy we want them to look at, because this is implicit, not explicit. I don't want to misstate the record. But what the jury would have known is, that's the guy that the victim said was the shooter. And that's the problem here.
So the way this would have come in is, I think the state admits that it came into evidence that the victim gave the photo. And then it would have come into evidence that it was pointed out that this particular person.
Correct.
Without saying who the person was that did it.
The quote is, it was pointed out that the person in that photo was the shooter. If there is no way that is not hearsay. Okay. The fact that it's done in passive voice and that it doesn't identify the speaker doesn't mean it's not hearsay. The officer doesn't say, like, oh, I recognize the shooter from the video. You know, that wouldn't be hearsay. It was pointed out, well, someone pointed it out to him. Who did it? I don't really care. It happens to be, we know it was Mr. Brown, but as far as the confrontation clause is concerned, I'm not sure it matters who the speaker is. What matters is the witness was allowed to convey out-of-court statement, offered that's testimonial, and that is highly, highly, highly damaging to the defendant. Now, if the hearsay rulings had come out other ways, if the defense had been allowed, as they maybe thought they were going to be able to impeach that statement by admitting the later statement from the witness that he actually didn't see who the shooter was, well, then, you know, maybe that gets cured somewhere along the line. But as happens, and as Your Honor pointed out in questions to Mr. Petras, the prosecutor is able to tell the jury in closing multiple times that the victim, you use so many words, that the shooter was identified in that photo. That wouldn't happen in a murder case. That wouldn't happen if the shooter was dead, and it shouldn't have happened here. And that's the, when you have a case about identity, and you can't look at those tapes and see who the shooter is, you can't underappreciate the importance of that particular piece of evidence and the evidentiary rules that followed from it. Mr. Williams is not entitled to a perfect trial, but he's entitled to a fair trial with evidence that's lawfully admitted and not in violation of his constitutional rights, and that's all he asks for. Respectfully request that you reverse the conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.